It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the new hip-hop sensation Iggy Azalea and why many critics say she is offending African Americans and the hip-hop community.
But first, the UW System Board of Regents unanimously passed the system's 2015-17 biennial budget proposal yesterday, which includes a request for $95 million over the next 2 years.
The budget raised eyebrows given the size of the request and the fact that Governor Walker has said that no state agency would be granted budget increases. UW System President Ray Cross joins us now for more details about this request. Welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, you've asked the state for a $95 million increase for the 2015-2017 biennial budget cycle. Is this a little optimistic given that the governor has said state agencies shouldn't expect an increase?
Well, we're not really technically similar to other state agencies, even though we're part of the state, so I understand that. But we've been having conversations with him all along about this and about the components of it, and we believe that this is an investment in those things the state needs to invest in order to generate the kind of jobs to secure the kind of economic growth that this state needs. And he's sympathetic to that. We've had a number of conversations with his staff and others in the executive branch, as well as legislators. This is the kind of stuff they would like to be able to do. I think the big question is, can we afford it? Yeah, that's a fair question. And there are a lot of fair questions about this proposal. The whole idea is to put a proposal on the table that we think helps the state's economy, helps generate jobs, jobs that create jobs. And I think that's what the state needs. And so we're putting it on the table, and we're more than willing to engage in that conversation.
So talk a little bit about what this money would go toward. I understand it's called the Talent Development Initiative.
That the Talent Development Initiative has three components. The talent path. The talent path is to help escort more students into and through the educational pipeline. We have to do a better job on the front end of getting students into the system, in through high school and into the system. We have to do a better job of retaining them. We have to do a better job of connecting them to employers and businesses in the state through a multitude of means. So those are the people, the young working adults, that will fuel the economy in the future, particularly if we can educate them in areas of high impact. And that's the focus of this effort. So that's the talent path. The second is the talent infrastructure. In order to do that, I need faculty and programs, whether it's water-related or it's nursing or it's engineering or it's biology or science. Those programs, for the most part, enrollment is full. So I'm at capacity. How do I grow those programs? I just take nursing, for instance. I think there's a 36% gap over the next few years in that area. It's hard to find nursing faculty. We need those kinds of programs. And so I need the infrastructure to support that in terms of people, the support systems and facilities. We mostly have a lot of the facilities, but we need equipment and things like that. So the infrastructure to support that growth is important. The third piece, and I'm going on here, Cynthia, but the third piece is the whole talent-based economy. It's one thing to have high-impact jobs and high-impact talent, but you also need to create high-impact opportunities. So we need to launch businesses and grow businesses, particularly in high-impact areas.
Well, the UW system had been in the news previously for a $650 million cash reserve, and some might say, well, why do you need more money now?
Well, first of all, the state operates on a cash accounting basis. So what you have in the bank at any given time is considered cash. In reality, we probably should be operating on an accrual basis because 40% of that money was due or owed. I had an invoice, a purchase order, a bill for that money. So that's really not cash in the bank, even though it appears that way in a cash accounting system. Another 20% was planned. We had actual plans to repair a roof or fix this or do something like that. And another 20% is designated. It's in a box. I can only spend it on items within that box. So we really had less than roughly $200 million in that box that would, could be called reserves. The rest of it was committed in some fashion. Now, the challenge for us is to explain that clearly, document that well. We didn't, I don't think, explain it as well as we could have. It wasn't as clearly understood. And so it looked out of place. And so I understand that. That's important. I argue that if we can't explain that well, there's no way we can expect to have a positive budget this year. So the burden is on us. Those are all fair questions, not only coming from legislators who represent the public, but internally, our own people are raising those questions.
Why make this proposal for a request for a $95 million investment in this talent initiative now, rather than, say, waiting for the next biennial budget, 2 more years?
Well, the state's economy has been growing at about a 3.3% rate annually for the last 10 years, average. Wisconsin's economy is growing at about Minnesota's growing at about 3.5. North Dakota is about 8.0, for obvious reasons, different reasons. The challenge here is, are we content by the time you subtract inflation out of that? You're really down to 1.5%. So are we content to have our economy grow at a 1 to 1.5% real rate? And that limits the amount of job opportunities. No, I think we want it to grow faster. In order to do that, in order to achieve the kind of things we all want our economy to do, we have to grow our economy faster. Now, that's not the only thing the university does. It's important to understand that. But the university plays an incredibly important role as an economic engine, not just in developing the talent, but creating the ideas, the innovation, those kinds of things that spawn incredible investment and spur an economy in ways that you can't imagine. All you have to do is look at Stanford and the Silicon Valley, the whole research triangle in North Carolina. Our universities are this hotbed in regionalism of just incredible economic growth. Can we spread that throughout the state? I think we can, and I think this proposal suggests that we've got an idea to do it.
And part of the proposal is also for a continuation of previous initiatives or those that are already ongoing. What do you hope to prolong and why?
Well, I think the continuation relates to the economic development incentive grants. We're calling that the talent-based economy. We have had considerable initial success with that original investment. That was our own money put forward into that. We think we can expand that tremendously. A lot of that deals with launching new companies and growing existing companies. We know that the most job growth opportunities are in those companies between 10 and 100 employees. How do we help them grow? And that's part of this challenge, as well as launching new companies. And we're committed to be a part of that.
You've made a point in your presidency at the UW system so far to repair and build relationships with lawmakers and with Governor Walker. How has that been going? And do you think that that will lead to a positive outcome with your proposal?
Oh, I don't think, Cynthia, I don't think my relationship will accomplish anything. These are honest, straightforward, tough critics. They look at this from a realistic perspective. I want them to. We all want them to. That's their job. And coming at it from different perspectives and challenging us every way, I like that. I think that's entirely appropriate. I think there is an improved relationship. For the most part, it's because of them. They've reached out to me and have been gracious, so I appreciate that very much. But it gives us the opportunity to talk, whether we agree or disagree. I want to be a person that listens carefully to that criticism, and I hope make adjustments where appropriate, argue vigorously for what I believe, do it with a smile and in a way that is respectful.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
That was President Ray Cross of the University of Wisconsin System. This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, WPR's news director Michael Leland gets us up to speed on some of the top headlines from around the state, including a look at recent talks between the EPA and some Native American leaders.
First, the Video Music Awards are this weekend. They are an awards show known for pushing boundaries, making headlines, and sometimes offending. We thought it would be a good time to talk about one of the biggest musical sensations and controversies of the moment.
She's performing at the Video Music Awards this weekend, and her name is Amethyst Amelia Kelly, or more commonly known by her stage name Iggy Azalea. Iggy's rise to stardom has been historical. She's the first artist since the Beatles to rank simultaneously at both numbers 1 and 2 on the Billboard Top 100 chart with her first two songs. Only a month after the release of her debut album, Forbes magazine called her the woman running hip-hop.
While her commercial success may be clear, her acceptance within the industry and among culture critics is anything but. Iggy is a blonde, white, Australian woman, but her music is in the style of hip-hop from the American South. And while many white artists have appropriated typically black music in the past, many say Iggy is particularly offensive for the way she mimics an African-American-sounding hip-hop voice.
Here to talk with us about responses to Iggy Azalea's music and how white artists have used black music historically is Travis Gosa. He's an assistant professor of American Studies at Cornell University, researching race and music. His article about the topic on The Root is called The Conspiracy to Whitewash Hip-Hop, Why Iggy Azalea's Music is So Popular and Problematic. Travis, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, white artists have been using the styles and lyrics of black music throughout American music history. Is there something different about Iggy Azalea that gets people worked up?
Iggy certainly represents a long line of white artists who have come to the U.S., borrowed and mimicked the music, accent, and styles of black Americans and repackaged it for white audiences or the global marketplaces. What I think is amazing about Iggy Azalea is that she really represents the first time in the past 50 years since the British invasion that a white artist has been so good at doing this.
Well, let's talk about that by listening to some examples. Now, one of the things that seems to stick in people's craws when we're talking about this issue is the difference between her natural speaking voice and then her presence as an artist. This is her speaking in an interview.
I first decided I would like to have a music career when I was about 14. And I remember I thought I could probably get a record deal in a year. That was what I thought. It takes a year. It's pretty easy. And I thought, all I have to do is see my potential. So I'll record 3 songs. And I'll send this 3-song demo to a label. I'll send it to every label, and one of them will pick me.
All right, there she is speaking in an interview. And here she is performing.
Hit the club with bad bitches. Stack of hundreds.
And what?
Bunch of 50s.
Okay.
Super clean.
Uh-huh.
Shout, get them.
Yeah.
Hit the scene, kill. We in the murder business. I kill pride. I hurt feelings. Click, clack, bang, bang. We in the murder business. My outfit. The murder. Click, clack, bang, bang. We in the murder business. Iggy, do a Biggie. Tell him keep sending bottles. I'm a pop 50.
And you've got obviously a huge difference there between, you know, the off-screen Iggy and the performing Iggy. You can hear the difference in her voice, the affectation there, the change in style, if we're going to be kind about it. Is this what makes her offensive to the hip-hop community?
This is one of the major issues that people have taken with Iggy Azalea. One of the most important aspects of hip-hop culture is the idea that you have to be real, right? That authenticity and sincerity has always been privileged in the culture. And so what it means is that if you rap about the streets, you should have lived a street life. If you're from Australia, perhaps, right, you shouldn't be using this stereotypical Southern drawl. One thing that I've said in the past is that, you know, it doesn't go both ways. Imagine me as an African-American male from the American South. If I went to Australia, right, after seeing Crocodile Dundee and began speaking in a stereotypical Australian accent, right, you know, claiming that a dango ate my baby or, you know, anything, those types of stereotypes of how people from the American South sound, really, I think, represents one of the major reasons why critics have questioned her authenticity to the culture. You know, one thing that I think is amazing is that there have always been white rap artists in American hip hop, right? We can think, go all the way back to 1981 with Blondie's Rapture, right? This is sort of an early disco rap song, probably one of the first songs that anyone outside of New York heard after Rapper's Delight. That was a white female. So it's not just that she's white and Australian, it's that people have been very concerned about what seems to be her desire to be the first post-hip-hop rapper, someone who seems to be circumventing many of those gatekeeping mechanisms to where you have to have black audiences that you want your music played on urban radio. In many ways, Iggy Azalea represents the first post-hip-hop rapper because she's risen to success without any support or viewership or listenership from traditional urban black markets.
And yet her mentor is a guy named T.I., an African-American, who is supporting her and apparently doesn't see any sort of dissonance going on here. How do you explain that?
Well, traditionally, white rappers have used black mentors to signal their authenticity and sincerity in the market. We can go back and think about the importance of Eminem, right, the famous rapper from Detroit, the importance of him being linked and mentored to Dr. Dre early in his career, to Royce da 5'9" and Proof, two prominent black Detroit artists. So in many ways, I've seen Iggy Azalea dodge some of the criticism given the cachet of T.I. and Southern hip-hop. But beyond T.I., who is her mentor and owns her contract, most critics, most DJs have been very critical of Iggy Azalea. I'm thinking about Funkmaster Flex on Hot 97, you know, had her in the booth during an interview, played her new record and said, "This is garbage," right? That this is the worst thing I've heard in years. The only reason why he said he was playing it on the station is because they were contractually obligated.
And another argument that I've heard is from black women saying that she's crowding out black women who have authentic voices in hip hop and have to fight to get their airtime to begin with. And now you have this Caucasian woman who's you know, pretty much sitting on the throne of women's hip hop, of all hip hop, if you read the stories. What do you think about that argument?
For the past 2 years, Iggy Azalea has been criticized not just by tastemakers, music critics, and cultural writers, but by the few black female hip-hop artists who remain in the industry. I'm thinking first and foremost about Azalea Banks, not to be confused with Iggy Azalea. Azalea Banks, a black female rapper, has basically described Iggy Azalea's music as a new minstrel show. Right, accusing Iggy Azalea of stealing the culture, crowding out other female artists who are trying to make it. But I think the most prominent critique has come from the former reigning queen of hip-hop, Nicki Minaj. Right? Nicki Minaj has been very vocal of what she sees as a pretty much a whitewashing of rap music by Iggy Azalea. During the last music awards, she called out Iggy Azalea as being not just inauthentic, but as someone who doesn't write her own rhymes. And so in the world of hip hop, the accusation that you don't write your own rhymes is similar to sacrilege in religion. And so there has been much critique from the few black female artists who remain in the industry.
And she's making a ton of money, so it's not just an argument about cultural appropriation. It's that, you know, she is, and you know, the companies that back her are making money hand over fist. How does that figure into this?
Well, one thing that's amazing about Iggy Azalea is that she seems to be benefiting not just from her model looks or from her relationship with T.I., but she seems to be part of this new program by Clear Channel called the Verge Program. And what that means is that the 850 Clear Channel radio stations around the nation was obligated to play her song Fancy 150 times a month at minimum. Clear Channel radio stations have about 250 listeners on average. Multiply that by playing it 150 times on 850 stations, we have a recipe for a pop hit. One thing that I've been interested in is whether or not Iggy Azalea is really interested in a long-term rap career. She seems to be interested in modeling and product endorsements.
And we're going to have to leave it there for now. We want to take a listen to the song that you've been talking about, Fancy, as we speak with Travis Gosa, Assistant Professor of American Studies at Cornell, talking about Iggy Azalea and her hip-hop music. She's been criticized for appropriating Black hip-hop culture in her music. And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think? Do you think some artists are successful and others are offensive when appropriating Black music? You can call us or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We go out with her song, Fancy. You're listening to Central Time.
Things first, I'm the realest, realest. Drop this, and let the whole
this is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about white artists using and performing typically Black music. Overnight hip-hop sensation Iggy Azalea is a blonde white Australian woman and has been criticized for offending the hip-hop community by using the voice of Southern African-American hip-hop. We're speaking now with Travis Gosa, Assistant Professor of African-American Studies at Cornell University, where he studies race and music.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about white artists appropriating typically Black music? It has been a part of music history from Elvis to the Beatles to Vanilla Ice. Is it sometimes okay and other times offensive? Let us know what you think at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go now to our callers. We've got Mike with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how's it going? First of all, I just want to say that I think we as people, Black people in general, are taking this a little too serious. Hip-hop has been diluted for a very long time now, ever since the rapping grannies have been around. And we take rap artists and artists and entertainments in general too literal and too serious. These people are just entertainment. So by us holding on to this thing that we want to hold on to as hip-hop and things as our own, we're kind of just putting ourselves back in the overall picture. I mean, people being real in the hip-hop community, that has been falsified for so long. And everybody who listens to rap knows this. So who cares what she's doing? I mean, if anything, it's spreading the music and people are listening to it and having a good time. I mean, why take it so serious?
All right. Well, thanks a lot for your thoughts, Mike. Appreciate that. And what do you say to that, Travis? Is hip-hop already, you know, an art form that is diluted? There is no such thing as pure hip-hop anymore, so why get upset about Iggy?
Well, thanks, Mike, for the question. I think the caller had, I think, was vocalizing what many people have said in response to Iggy Azalea. What are the stakes at risk of this new artist coming and dominating pop music? First thing I would say is that for African Americans, music has always historically been more than just music and entertainment, right? From the oohs and ahs of the cotton fields during slavery, during sharecropping, from Can't See in the Morning to Can't See at Night, right? Music has been the soundtrack of people who have needed it as a social resource, right, to deal with structural inequality and racism in America. In the 1960s, right, we, of course, did not expect, we've never expected hip-hop artists to be leaders or to direct Black America. But music has been the soundtrack of struggle. It's been so much more than entertainment. And so I think what the caller is pointing at is that this has changed with hip-hop. I think it's probably the 1990s when Snoop Dogg released his first debut album with the hit song Gin and Juice. I think for many hip-hop fans, that was the first moment where people said, wait a minute, this is no longer the era of Fight the Power, Public Enemy, of hip-hop being the quote-unquote the Black man's CNN. And so it has been a few decades in which people have wondered, you know, does hip-hop still really still have the cachet of being a real lens to the black experience? Clearly with Iggy Azalea, the answer is no. This is, you just played Fancy. This is a great song for shopping at the mall, for perhaps having a pillow fight at a sleepover. Certainly, Iggy is not trying to tap into that longer history of black music that has really been the soundtrack of struggle.
Isn't music sometimes just simply a culture of borrowing, though? If we look at you all the way back to the Renaissance, there were things called paraphrase masses where people just ripped someone else's music and plugged it in. If you look at jazz, that's a place where you grab someone else's tune, you play it, and then you riff on that. Isn't that, in a sense, what's going on here?
Hip-hop has a long history, an important history of sampling and reconfiguring former music to make something new and innovative. I think the key is to borrow and sample in a way that doesn't amount to a type of symbolic violence. I'm really struck by what Amiri Baraka, the famous black arts poet, said back in the mid-60s, right? He was watching the British invasion, watching the Stones and Beatles. And this is the joke he used to tell, right? He said, what's the difference between the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, and the minstrel shows of the 19th century? Well, the answer for him is that the minstrels never convinced anyone that they were black, which is a very funny joke if you get what he's trying to say, is that first what made these two groups, the Beatles and the Stones, so great is that if you close your eyes, they were so great at emulating the R&B, blues, and rock artists of the time that you swore, right, that they were actually black artists. But they did so with love, sincerity, and appreciation for those artists. The question with Iggy Azalea, is she really paying tribute to the artist that paved the way for more than 40 years for her to be able to enter hip-hop at a time in which it is valuable popular culture?
Now, people have drawn comparisons between Iggy Azalea and other white hip-hop artists like Vanilla Ice, who have also tried to boost their credibility, their authenticity, by tweaking their life stories. And here's Vanilla Ice's version of that.
Ready for the chumps on the wall. The chumps acting ill because they're full of eight ball. Gunshots ranged out like a bell. I grabbed my nine, all I heard was shells. Falling on the concrete real fast. Jumped in my car, slammed on the gas. Bumper to bumper, the avenue's packed. Trying to get away before the jack is jacked. Police on the scene, you know what I mean? They passed me up, could run it all. The dope fiends, if there was a problem, yo, I'll solve it. Check out the hook while my DJ revolves it.
All right, famous song there. Unfortunately for Vanilla Ice, not exactly what happened to him when he was growing up. That was not his experience. And if Iggy Azalea had a different life story somehow, where she was, you know, living an experience that was more authentic, do you think people would still have the problem that they have with her?
Iggy Azalea, in a way, has tried to avoid the Vanilla Ice trap. Back in the early 1990s, Vanilla Ice really represented the worst things that white artists could do trying to get into rap music. That is fully fabricating a life history that draws on the stereotypes of struggle, drug dealing, crime. You know, one thing that Vanilla Ice did, besides change his name from Robert Van Winkle to Vanilla Ice, right? Robert Van Winkle is not a good rap name.
That's not a good rap name.
Was to pretend to be a gangster from Miami, claimed that he had gang affiliations. At one point, he claimed that he had been shot and or stabbed while committing crimes. This, in a way, represents a type of inauthentic construction of biography that Iggy Azalea has been able to avoid. What she does is to say, hey, I'm white, I'm from Australia, but I have a similar story of struggle, right? I wasn't affluent in Australia. I came to the U.S. with no money. I struggled on the streets trying to juggle jobs during my modeling career. And in a way, I think she has avoided the Vanilla Ice trap. One of my concerns, though, is that there's been a few missteps that echoes Vanilla Ice. First, Iggy Azalea has referred to herself as a slave master in one of her songs, mm-hmm. right? Threatening to destroy other rappers who are runaway slaves. This really demonstrates that she may not be familiar with African-American culture, African-American history. At one point, there was a viral tweet going around in which she allegedly used the N-word when referring to her fellow, artists, right? It turns out that it may or may not have been a true tweet, but this caused some controversy. And so while she hasn't had the fake biography problem, she has really ruffled the feathers of people who are skeptical that she is an authentic artist.
Well, we've got a lot of folks waiting to talk to you, so let's go to the phones right now and take Scott in Nisida. Hi, Scott.
Hi there. Well, thank you for the show. I always enjoy listening to you folks. Well, I first of all, not all black African or American music is about struggle. You know, I really love Pharrell Williams' Happy, for example, and I love a lot of the Motown stuff that isn't about struggle. It's just, it's fun. I love it, a lot of it is. Aside from that, the reason I call is to say that Iggy Azalea would, if she would make some kind of comment stating that she has no direct experience of living as a black African-American, Iggy Azalea would have no more, would she be no more offensive than a black African-American borrowing any of the European music legacy, kind of what you were saying a little while ago. You know, it's like, well, don't we all borrow from something? So it's kind of adding to that. So that's all.
All right. Thanks a lot, Scott, and thanks for listening. And Travis, what do you say to that?
Thanks, Scott, for the question. One thing that I think his comments should direct our attention to is that this is not just hip-hop or rap music that this is occurring with. Similar complaints issued against Iggy Azalea have been forwarded at white R&B artists such as Justin Timberlake or Robin Thicke, right, of being sort of two prominent white R&B artists. And so in last year's awards show, a funny thing happened, that last year was the first year in which there were no African Americans who had a number one song, right? We looked at the award shows and many of the artists, right, seemed to be white artists performing hip hop and R&B. So I agree that it goes way beyond rap music. One thing that I've been fascinated with is looking at the bro country phenomenon. And this is really white country artists who aren't just doing pop music, but they're incorporating hip-hop, rapping, R&B producers in their music, right? And so I'm thinking about the new Miranda Lambert CD I listened to the other day, right? She's rapping on it. She's talking about car truck rims, people twerking on the back of cornfields in some of these bro country videos. And so these controversies about the racial boundaries of pop music, I think, go way beyond rap music.
So when you look at this history of music and appropriation and the line that sometimes gets crossed over, are there white artists that you think have been successful at, you know, maybe paying tribute to the African-American music that they're borrowing from and staying respectful?
I think so. I've already pointed to Eminem as someone who has proved that he is a sincere member of the hip-hop community. I think in looking in the 1980s, we can talk about the Beastie Boys. In the 1990s, we can think about groups such as Third Bass. Today, you have several prominent white hip-hop artists who are quite respected in the hip-hop community. I'm thinking about Action Bronson, a New York rapper right now. But I think some of the white artists have to be very careful about the lines that they cross. Someone like Mac Miller, a Pittsburgh rapper, has been accused throughout his career of stealing the music and lyrics of black artists. So I think that's a case in which he seems to be crossing the line of paying tribute and homage to artists who have come before to maybe crossing into outright theft of previous artists' music.
So, Travis, in our last 30 seconds here, with the Video Music Awards coming up this Sunday, is there anything Iggy can do to redeem herself?
It is my hope that Iggy will avoid the sensational gimmicks of kissing Britney Spears or Madonna. And this could be her first moment in which she can have a performance in which she shows the world that she can be a great live performer. In the past, she's been plagued by cases in which she's been clearly lip-syncing, times in which she has to stop rapping in order to dance. And so I would love for Iggy Azalea to come out this weekend and demonstrate that she is a force to be reckoned with.
All right, Travis, thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Travis Goza, Assistant Professor of American Studies at Cornell University. He researches race and music. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster.
It's time for our weekly state news roundup. Today, we look at the week's recent meetings between some Native American leaders from Wisconsin and the EPA about a state iron ore mine and an update on court rulings about same-sex marriage coming up.
Michael Leland joins us now. He's WPR's news director. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first off, the dust hasn't yet settled from Wisconsin's primary elections. Can you get us up to speed on the races that are still up in the air?
Yeah, the canvassing is pretty much done. Well, it is done. The 6th Congressional District, there was a Republican primary. This is to replace retiring Tom Petri. Glenn Grothman appears to have won this race. He has a 219-vote lead over Joe Lipum. Dewey Strobel and Tom Dino finished further back. Now, the question is there going to be a recount? Well, we don't know yet because there aren't any automatic recounts in these races. Lipum would have to request one, and he has until 5 o'clock Monday afternoon to do that. He said that he's going to think about it for a few days, talk to his staffers, and decide how to move forward. Either way, the winner will face Winnebago County Executive Mark Harris for the right to replace Congressman Petri.
And what's the outlook in the general election for that race? Is the winner of the Republican primary a favorite for the general election, or will it be a tough battle?
It's kind of hard to say. Of course, Tom Petri is a Republican, so this is a district that has gone Republican for the past many elections. But that's why they have elections. We'll find out on Election Day. But I would say that the Republican is likely to be a favorite in that race.
And there were some close races on the state level, too. What's going on there?
Yeah, there is one recount that is underway already. That's in the 87th Assembly District in northwest Wisconsin, where James Edming leads Michael Bubb by 17 votes after the official canvassing. Bubb did ask for a recount, and that's being done. They have 13 days to complete that. And then there's another race in the state Senate district, the Democratic primary, 17th District. That's in southwest Wisconsin. Ernie Whitwer leads Pat Bomhack by 7 votes. Bomhack is expected to ask for a recount, and that would, if that happens, again, the request has to be in by Monday afternoon. That would likely start next week.
And how long might it take before we get a final word on that?
They have 13 days to complete a recount, so less than that, most likely.
Well, meanwhile, the UW system is asking for $95 million for a new initiative. First of all, how politically touchy is it to ask for such a large sum of money at this time?
Well, it really depends. I mean, ordinarily, you would expect to hear, people saying, how dare the university ask for this extra money at a time when budgets are tight. Haven't heard so much of that so far. But yeah, the university is asking for $95 million over the next two-year budget cycle, above what its usual outlay from the state would be. And this is coming at a time when the governor has told state agencies not to expect any increases in the next budget. But the UW says this money is for an important initiative that would help the state in the long run. And a little bit about it, it's called the Talent Development Initiative. Some of the money that President Ray Cross is asking for would be used for programs that would help grow businesses in the state and help faculty members or student entrepreneurs. Some of it would be used to get more high school students to take college credits, college courses early, and also cover the increasing enrollment for the system's Flex Option program. And that's a program that allows adults to earn credits with real-life experiences and by taking exams.
And what can we expect from the state? Do you think that the governor will go for this?
Hard to say. This will all be taken up in the next budget cycle. President Cross says this request isn't coming as a surprise to the governor or Republicans in the legislature. He says he's been meeting with people in the governor's office and with key legislators to talk about this, let them know it's coming, let them know why he feels it's important. A spokeswoman for the governor's office said yesterday that the administration would consider this request, just like it does requests from other agencies in the state. And really, there's been no big reaction as of yet from any members of the legislature. So, we'll see what happens after January.
And I imagine the system president also anticipates that the state will reap a lot of benefits, too, in the long term by investing in something like this. By the way, we did talk to Ray Cross earlier this afternoon, and if you missed that interview, you can listen to it back at WPR.org/centraltime. Let's move on to some recent meetings this week between some Native American leaders and the EPA. What was the purpose of the meetings?
Yeah, this is part of a series of meetings that's held a couple times a year. The EPA's Midwest representatives discuss a variety of matters with Native American leaders from Wisconsin and a number of surrounding states. Five Wisconsin tribes sent representatives to the meetings, which were in Traverse City, Michigan this week. Now, they weren't open to the public. They weren't open to the media, so we don't know everything that happened in the meetings. But WPR's Chuck Quernbach was on hand. He was sitting out in the hall while these meetings were going on and ready to talk to people as they come out. A number of tribal representatives agreed to speak with Chuck, and he reported back that one of the key issues discussed was making sure that the federal government does all it can to protect air, land, and water, and that the EPA works with other agencies in that effort.
Are there other issues on the table?
Yeah, of course. The big proposed iron ore mine in the Pinoki Hills in far northern Wisconsin was part of the discussion. The Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewas Chairman Mike Wiggins said that he asked the EPA to use part of the Clean Water Act to potentially stop that proposed mine, and he says it won't be the last time that he makes that request.
Well, and it sounds like there were some other general environmental issues on the radar as well.
Sure. The tribes would like the EPA to do more to fight climate change. They're worried that increasing global temperatures are going to hurt several resources that they depend on, things like wild rice beds and fish spawning areas.
Lots to keep an eye on, and I'm sure we'll be following up on that on the show as well. Lastly, you're looking ahead at Wisconsin's recent rulings on same-sex marriage. What's happening next week?
Right. It's going to be heard in court on Tuesday. The 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals is going to hear about the constitutionality of Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriage. This is one that's been in effect since 2006. The state's had a constitutional amendment in place defining marriage as being between a man and a woman. In June, federal judge Barbara Crabb said that ban was unconstitutional. And for about a week, as you remember, most Wisconsin counties were issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples. I think about 500 were issued or so. That's before the state attorney general, J.B. Van Hollen, appealed the ruling, and the judge put a stay on her order, basically shutting off the tap of marriage licenses for now anyway.
And the testimony is being given in a Chicago court. Is the court zooming in on Wisconsin, or are there similar cases being heard?
It's a three-judge panel. It'll hear arguments about Wisconsin's ban. It's also considering a similar ban in Indiana. So they're folding those two cases together in part to expedite this issue because a lot of the arguments and questions are the same. So those two cases have been combined in court and will be heard by the panel on Tuesday.
And we'll see more activists outside the court as well. This is a huge issue this year in Wisconsin and the country.
Yes, supporters of same-sex marriage are doing a bus tour between Wisconsin and Chicago. They're planning several news conferences along the way. They'll talk about their position. They're planning a rally in downtown Chicago Monday evening. That's the night before the court hearing. And WPR's Sean Johnson will be in Chicago for the hearings, and we'll be looking forward to his reports.
Yeah. Well, what else is on the radar for next week? What can we look forward to from the news department?
You'll have to listen, to be sure. It's a secret.
Michael Leland, he always knows how to keep us hooked. Michael, thanks for being with us
this week.
Have a
great weekend.
Michael Leland is our news director here at WPR.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.